Yet no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in this room tonight and listening later on abbaclub.org desperately in need will hear our speaker tonight. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight we've got Larry Scott. We're Not a Glum Lot at the Mount Vernon Church in Dunwoody, telling his story. And I'm a newcomer here, and I just met Larry just a few weeks back. He was at the Buford Speaker Meeting on Sunday night that just got started in the last year, Fusion Church. And Larry is a very dynamic individual, but he's got a great grasp on the big book, and he's got a great message. So lend him your ear. Welcome, Larry.
Man, it's crazy to be in the room. I was getting dressed tonight, and I was thinking about the people that have stood behind this podium. I've been coming to this room since 1987. And if I allow my self-centered fear to get in the way, I can become completely locked down. I was out there looking at the Hall of Fame out on the wall, and I knew most of those cats as they came through here as presidents, and a lot of heroes, man, a lot of legacies. I could call so many names, but the guy whose name is on the front of this podium taught me incredible gifts that I still employ today. It's always an honor, and it's an overused term, but it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything. As this little yarn unfolds tonight, you'll see, because you're listening to a homeless guy up here. I know I don't look like it. And if you want to take it a step further, I'm a dead guy, really. And this guy's name is Larry Scott, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm free tonight. You know, there's a couple of... I get the opportunity to go to really cool places all over the globe and meet some really neat people and do some good stuff and hopefully carry this message that can further help somebody on their path. We were recently in Hawkinsville, Georgia, a mere mecca of racehorses, I guess. There's these old drunks down there, a couple of drunks. I don't know if they were alcoholics, but they were out fishing one day in a farm hunt. And knocking a few cold ones back, and one of them got hung up on the bottom. He started pulling and jerking, and Tom looked at him and said, Bob, what do you got there, son? He said, well, I don't know. I'm hung up on something. He kept pulling and jerking, and finally it broke loose, and he pulled it up, and it was a lamp. He brushed all the mud off of it, and this genie popped out, and he says, thank you so much. He said, I've been lodging this mud in the bottom of this thing for 2,000 years. He says, for that, I'm going to grant you a wish. Bob said, really? He said, yep, anything you want. Well, Bob scratched his head, took a couple sips on that Budweiser. He said, turn this whole pond into beer. Genie said, really? He said, yes, sir. Whole thing, just turn it into beer. He said, all right. Snapped his fingers and poof. Whole pond turned into Budweiser beer. Tom looked at him and said, way to go, Bob. Now we got to pee in the boat. It's the day before Mother's Day, May the 12th, 1935. Broke down stockbroker by the name of William Griffith Wilson Bill is in Akron, Ohio on a business deal that went south. And he's about to drink. Bill's got 5.5 months between him and his last drink, and he is scared to death as he's wandering around the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, broke. Doesn't have enough money to pay his bill. And in the book, he says sanity returned because he was about to drink. He had already rationalized 3 drinks in his mind. And he went over to the payphone and he made 1 phone call. If you watch the movie, My Name is Bill Dovey, that's a little dramatized. He made 1 call and they got a hold of a guy, a preacher up there, who put him in touch with, through a turn of events, with a broke down proctologist named Dr. Bob Smith. Dr. Bob went over to the Cyberling Mansion the following day after he'd come out of a pretty bad case of the jitters, and he told him, he said, I'm going to give you 15 minutes. He says, but I don't know what you think you can do for me. He said, I've been prayed over and carved up more than a Christmas turkey. Bill looked him in the eye and he says, I'm not here for you, Dr. Smith. I'm here for me. And what began and promised to be a 15-minute conversation went on for darn near 6 hours. Later in life, Dr. Bob would write in our history that he had never met anybody that knew more about the game of drinking than Bill Wilson. And walk with me for a minute. Bill's got 5.5 months. What if Bill had walked in there and Bob said, please, Mr. Wilson, help me. I'm dying. Bill said, sorry, dude, I ain't got 5.5 months. You've got to call me in 6.5 because I ain't got a year. This is my opinion. I believe that once we have recovered from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and we're well on that path, we have the gift to help anybody that walks in our door. And that's going to kind of be the basis of what we talk about here tonight. In the 50s and 60s, something happened to Alcoholics Anonymous. There was an onset of treatment center facilities, and there's nothing wrong with those facilities or those people. They do a great job at what they do. They get our people stable, and they send them in here, and we give them a book and a meeting schedule and take them through the work. And that's what they do. But something happened in the 50s and 60s when these facilities started popping up all over the world, and their clients would come into our rooms. And our rooms at that particular point in time were basically speaker meetings and literature meetings. And what happened is we went from a program of recovery to a fellowship of sobriety, hence the discussion-type formats. And we hear all kinds of things about broken weed eaters and kids that make bad grades and dented car doors at the shopping center. None of which has one cotton-picking thing to do with recovery from alcoholism. December 31st, 1987, God intervened in my life. But that's not the beginning of this story. That's pretty much toward the tail end of it. When I tell you I'm free tonight, it means that I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I got a tag on the back of my car out there, sitting up in the corner. It says, recovered. That's my tag. I get little Waffle House napkins on my windshield all the time, people quoting the big book. Why we have a daily reprieve? Well, what about them 37 times the book tells me that I've recovered? Just saying. My home group is We Are Not a Glum Lot. We're a Joe and Charlie style book study. We meet on Thursday nights at Dunwoody United Methodist. Love to have you come and visit with us. It's a meeting that is typically 225 to 250 people. It was founded and grounded by the females that were hungry for the true message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And today the majority of our meeting is females. Come visit us. It's a lot of fun. My first drink when I was about 6 years old. And I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, but my family would send me down to Hazelhurst, Georgia. Back in the south, it's down in the southeast quadrant of our state, and I had family down there, and we would work in the fields, typically tobacco. And I was such a little fellow, they wouldn't let me actually get down and do the work, thank God. My job was to drive the tractors, and I love tractors. I love motorcycles. I love fast cars, shiny, loud motorcycles, and pretty girls. I love anything that makes a racket when you crank it up. And about noon time, the farmhands would come in out of the field, and the women folk would be in the house cooking up a big lunch for them. Well, my job was to go out to that 1,000-gallon gas tank and fill up the tractors. There was three of them. There was a Ford, a Farmall, and a John Deere. Well, it was an old hand-pump 1,000-gallon tank, and I'd lay up on the hood of them tractors, and I'd start pumping. Well, it didn't have automatic cutoff, so I'd be leaned in real close, listening for that gas to come up in the field net. What I discovered is I love gas. God, I love gas. They'd come out and find me passed out on the ground, big old grin on my face, that hose laying over there. Well, I'm a pretty quick study. End of the summer, I came back to Jacksonville. There was an Amoco station two blocks down the street. I went down and got me a job pumping gas. I love gas. back then, this is back in 100 years ago, I'd be down there filling up them old Cadillacs and Buicks and listening for that gas to come up in the fill next, because automatic cutoffs hadn't been invented yet. Well, they'd find me passed out in the driveway of the gas station. I love gas. I love what gas does to me. It went from that to sniffing glue. This was back before anybody knew much about it. 14 of us went to jail one morning. We were in junior high school. Police came down there and they said, y'all can't be doing what you're doing. They didn't know what to charge us. We just looked like we were having too much fun. They locked us all up. And we all had a little probationary period. My parents, you know, being dirt farmers, they didn't understand anything about sniffing glue, but they understood about stealing the glue and kicked my butt all over the place and put me on all kind of restriction because I stole the glue. But, right after that, me and a buddy of mine, who's still a dear friend, we'd scour the alleys back behind the retail shops down Main Street in Jacksonville, and we'd find these discarded bottles from the winos and the drunks and the homeless people. And we'd find these great big cork bottles, and we'd spin the cap off of it. It didn't matter what it was. We weren't discriminating. We'd pick up half pints, pints, whatever we could find, and we'd pour the remnants into one bottle. Once we'd get about that much in it, we'd flip a coin to get to see who got to drink it. And then it would rotate out every day. I mean, we're talking vodka, gin, bourbon, port wine. Lovely tasting stuff. It's a wonder I'm not dead from something that would scare the hell out of penicillin. Later in life, there was a club that opened in Jacksonville. And I was working in the radio business at the time. It was a place called The Other Place, and they would bring in regional bands. And on Wednesday nights, they had a thing there called Sink or Swim. You could go in there and get $15 at the door and drink all you could hold every Wednesday night. Well, I'm an alcoholic. Don't know it at the time. I just think I've got an over-exuberant taste for alcohol. So on the way to the Sink or Swim, all you can drink now, I'd stop and buy a pint and jacket before I got there just to get ready for Sink or Swim. I walked in the door south, and he gave me $15 and drank all I could hold. Got married young, child of the 60s, and there's a lot of stuff that I did. But here's what I want the newcomer in this room to hear, because you guys are coming in here with all kinds of stuff. You know, you're doing all this stuff that's out in the street. My first drug was alcohol. 6 years old, moonshine whiskey, hated it. My last drug was alcohol. December 31st, 1987. But all that stuff in between were nothing but fortifiers. I'd done a little bit too much of this. My teeth would clench down. You'd jack a little bit of gin or Jack Daniels and loosen you right up, get you back in the game. If you got just a little bit too weirded out on that stuff, you could drink a little Jack. And you know what I'm saying? So it was a fortifier to keep to enable me to drink more. I'm an alcoholic. And I love what my buddy Earl out in California says. My favorite thing is, what do you got? My second one is more. There's a part of this talk I want to get into. It's called luck versus grace. We walk around the planet. I don't know about you. I've OD'd and God has had his shot to take Larry Scott out a number of times. But for years I'd walk around and say, boy, what a lucky break. What a coincidence that I didn't. Had nothing to do with it, because once God has entered into my life, somewhere between step 2 and step 7 is when it happened in my life, I realized today that God had a bigger and better plan for me. Had nothing to do with luck. Luck is lottery. This ain't the lottery. This is life. I'm living with this cat in Jacksonville named Jimmy, and Jimmy owned a biker bar called Fling Nasty Saloon, and it was everything that name implied. It was about as big as from this guy right here to the wall. Carpet was sticky. You'd pull your tennis shoes off your feet. It was sticky. And it had all that psychedelic painting. And we was in there one night all tore up from the floor up, and this cat walked in. I'd never seen him before or since. He came up to me and said, do you like to fly? I said, I damn sure do. I don't know anything about it, but, you know, man up. He said, well, I got a little old plane out here at Hurlong Field. Let's go for a ride. It's a cold November night. And I said, let's go. So we get out there, and it's a grass runway. And there's a little old trailer house sitting over here. No lights in. And there's all these little airplanes lined up. He says, you wait right here, and I'll go get a key, and I'll signal you. I said, okay, fine. We're loaded. I mean, both of us are drunk as coots, and he gets out of the car and runs in that little trailer house. Light comes on, fumbles around, comes out. He waves, I waved. He jumped in this plane. Light came on. Nothing else happened. He got out. He waved. And I waved. He ran back in the trailer house. He come out and waved, and I waved. And he ran into another airplane. I'm a pretty quick study. It dawns on me we're stealing an airplane. Which brings to mind, does this guy even know how to fly? I think you have to be qualified for certain aircraft. Don't know, I'm just a drunk trying to figure it out. So finally on the third attempt, three trips, me waving, him waving. He jumps in, smoke belches out of this plane, and he waves. And I'm thinking, this would be a great time to say, you know what, I've had a change of heart. But I'm a man, I can't let him see me blank. I get out and I'm going, I'm probably not going to see this vehicle again. So I run over and get in this plane and put a headset on. He said, where do you want to go? Well, it's a cold November night, like midnight. And I'm thinking, well, where the hell are you going to go on a plane? Are we going to go cruise the Crystal? I said, well, let's go buzz the bar. He said, well, all right. Now, he hadn't called any clearance tower. He hadn't called the FAA. We stole a plane. Well, we're flying along, and he had gotten a hold of that bar somehow or another with some kind of radio, and it's over on Blanding Boulevard. Well, we get right down over the phone wires, and all these drunks and hippies and bikers are out in the parking lot doing this, and he buzzes right over the top of plane nests. I'm thinking, well, that's pretty cool. He said, where you want to go? I said, you're driving. So there's this river over there, the Ortega River. Anybody here from Jacksonville? Dave, you know the Temecula Bridge? Temecula Bridge goes over the Ortega River, and it's not a big bridge. Y'all think of Jacksonville. You're thinking of the Matthews and that. All them? Nuh-uh. This is the bridge. This is like, you know, one over the Chattahoochee and Roswell Road. And it's not square. It's got a half moon open. He gets his plane right down over the water. It's a cold November night. I'm freezing my butt off. I'm pretty quick study. I didn't take physics, but I'm looking at the width of these wings. And I'm looking at the opening of that bridge that's coming up on us quick. And I said, yep, this is it. This is not going to fit. Not even with Vaseline you're going to get this plane through. Well, obviously we did because I'm here with you tonight. But, you know, I ended up through radio. I met a lot of rock and roll bands that came through the radio station back in the day. And this story is not meant to impress you. We're going to give all this credit to God. I ended up living with Leon Wilkinson, the bass player with Lynyrd Skynyrd Band, and through that I got a job with their management team, Sir Productions, out of New York. And everything you've read about that band and their insanity, if you multiply it by 10, you got a little bit better picture. Well, the road is getting weary. It's even wearing on me, and I'm thinking, I don't know how much longer I want to do this. We just come out of New York City after three nights up there, and that was pretty much a straw that broke the camel's back for me, and I'm looking for a way out. So I get a hold of MCA Records, their label, and I've got a shot to move away from the road and go with their label. And it's October the 20th of 1977. There's an autograph signing party, and we're there, and I'm to meet this executive of MCA Records, and I got in an argument with that guy. And I did what I always did. Fear. Screw you, I'm not getting on the plane. And many of you know that was the final flight of the Freebird. They were to trade that plane off in Baton Rouge, Louisiana for a new Learjet. And this was an old twin prop plane that should have been junked years ago. Through pilot error, they didn't feel like that plane up. I had a friend come pick me up from the autograph signing and took me back to Jacksonville. And later that evening, we would get the news that the Freebird had fallen into the woods of the Tacoma, Mississippi. I lost a lot of friends that day. Sure did make me think, though. And in those days, I would tell you, what a lucky break. wasn't God's intention for me to get on that plane. It wasn't God's intention for me to die at the hands of others or of myself all that time I was out on that run that went on forever and ever and ever and ever. It's 1987. This girl I'd been in a relationship with off and on for 10 years comes home from work. She'd worked for the record company that I had moved to Atlanta, by the way, by this time. It's 1980 and gotten a job with a record company. But at this stage of the game, I'm unemployable. And nobody wants me. In order to work at a record company or in the music business, you pretty much have to be slamming it back, whatever it is. And I'm doing it so hard and so frequently and so crazy, they're telling me, we don't want you around here. You can't come around like this. You've got to go. And every place, I've had the greatest jobs in the world, and they would all say, you can't come around here like that anymore. You're going to have to leave now. And so it's 1987. I'd been in Atlanta for 7 years and plowed my way through some of the greatest employment opportunities a man would ever want. It's September 1987, and Michelle comes home from work. I'm much like Bill in the book, 40 pounds underweight. I could eat little or nothing because I was always loaded. She says, you're going to have to go because you're dying and you can't do that here. And I did what a stand-up guy does. I cussed her like a dog. But in retrospect, what that woman did is she gave me a freedom that is greater than anything I've ever known, because she, through that event, put my hand in your hand. So I'm homeless. I'm sleeping around here and there, abandoned cars, under bridges in the bush. Every now and then an acquaintance, not a friend, because I didn't have any friends left, they would say, you can come here and you can stay one night, but when I get up to go to work in the morning, you got to be gone. I had everything I owned was on my back, and it stunk. I'm staying at this woman's house in Lawrenceville, and my brother, who's just older than me, very flamboyant gay man, and that comes into play because he and I were not very close because of that. I was very hard on him. But he had found you some months before this particular period, and he called me. I don't know how he found me. I have no idea. Because this woman was a friend of some friends. And anyway, her phone rang and it was him. And he says, I hear you're in really bad shape. And if you don't get some help, we're going to bury you. Well, you know how we are. Tough guys. I said, no, Bub, I'm good. I got this. I'm dying. I'm thinking, in my mind, I've got AIDS. Because I'm telling you, you could count my ribs from afar. But he kept talking, and this is my running buddy back in the day. When you had affected his life, and when he got on the phone, his message to me, his conversation with me had depth and weight. I didn't have to say, how do you know about this? I knew he was an alcoholic. I'd had him locked up and institutionalized twice, me and my family. I mean, he's the cat that the police show up, he grabs their gun. He's alcoholic. It runs in our family. So finally, his message of death and weight finally broke through that shield I'd put up, and I said, well, what kind of idea you got? And he says, because I've been watching the Peachford commercials, you know. If you don't get help at Peachford, get help somewhere. And I'm homeless, right? And I said, Bob, I ain't got no resources, dude. I got nowhere to go. And he said, no, call this hotline number. I called the hotline number, and you met me at the door hospital over in Tucker. I can't remember the name of it now. I sat, and I don't remember who led, who read, don't know much about it. I do know that there are four people that were in that room that night that are still here today. And all I wanted to do was get my life back together, and I walked out of that room and asked the person that was giving me a ride to pull into Partners 2 Liquor Store on Lawrenceville Highway, because, see, that's a long walk from where you cats are sitting back there up here to get that chip. Damn, I needed a drink. You know what I'm saying? So they pulled into Partners 2. I bought two bottles of champagne to celebrate that coveted white chip. Makes sense to me. So for the next 30 days, I'd go to your stupid meetings, and I'd listen to your stupid stories and your stupid shares, and then I'd invite you back to the house to have a couple of beers and talk about how whacked out this whole thing was. And then comes the fateful day, December 31st, 1987. An acquaintance is allowing me to stay at their house one night. I started drinking somewhere early in that morning. This is not a love thing. This is a person that's got some mercy on Larry Scott. So she's in the kitchen cutting up collard greens, and there's this big pot like this, stock pot, full of rolling, boiling water on the stove. And what I'm going to tell you is pretty much hearsay, but I grabbed that pot of boiling water and I poured it on her arms. And then I proceeded to take my belt off with the big Western belt buckle and wrapped it around my hand and went through her house and just destroyed her stuff, her stereo, television, lamps, you name it. In a complete rage. Because you see, that's the way I give gratitude for giving me shelter and three squares. It's January 1st, 1988. I love college football, but I can't tell you who played, who won. I know nothing about what happened that day. I can tell you about the horror, the remorse, the guilt, the shame, and the insanity of alcoholic disease. I'm homeless again. Got nowhere else to go. This gal that I used to run with, again, not a love situation, it's a gal that I used to use with a lot. She allowed me, because I'm in bad shape, she allowed me to stay at her place one night. And while I'm there, I remembered something about a third step something in this old book. And somebody said, this is a great place to make a beginning with your walk with God. And God, what is that? So I'm down to my skivvies and no shirt, and I'm sleeping on this day bed in her house that's covered with animal hair and urine and dirt. This is where dogs and cats slept. And I remember that the smell, the stench, the grit and the grime grinding into my skin, and I thought, is this all there is? And I rolled out on my knees, and I uttered that prayer to the best of my recollection. And something happened that night. I'm not going to tell you it was a burning bush. There were no white lights or flashes or voices. It's just a feeling of I never had to be alone again. Because you see, this time when I come in, there was no middle-of-the-road solution. There was no more trying to talk you out of your path. There was no more just don't drink and go to meetings, Larry. That path wasn't working for me. Bottom of page 25, that's what it says. We believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution for alcoholics of my type. I need to know the real deal. I need it all. I can no longer do the one-two out. I can't do that anymore because I'm dying. So I start hanging out with my brother over at over in Bynum's. A lot of Atlanta legacies over there. Average sobriety in that room is about 35 years. And I'd go in early because you told me I needed to do that and help these cats set up. And old-timers treated me badly. You know, guy says, hey, Larry, how you doing? I said, Bob, I'm not doing good. I'm over here trying to sell used cars, and they're treating me like dirt, and I owe them money for working there. I'm going to draw against commission. He said, well, you're right on schedule, buddy. He's exactly where you're supposed to be. And I'm looking at Bob, seeing if he's wearing a hearing aid. We're in a little squared-off circle over at Bunny's one night, and there's this old guy named Jack Blaylock that's crossed over now. But Jack liked to sit in the room back when you could smoke. And he would smoke Luckies, them unfiltered Luckies, down to a roach. And it went around, and it got to me, and they said, well, Larry, what's going on with you? And I said, well, today kind of got off to a rocky start, but I used one of the tools that you've given me, turning it over. And I went into the men's room, and I pulled down some paper towel, put it on the floor, grabbed the sink, and I turned my day over to God. And ever since, everything has been just fine. Jack goes, yeah, turn it over, some good stuff, Larry boy. He said, back when I was in Alabama, I used to write them bad checks. He said, I turned them over to God. He turned them over to the sheriff. He'd come and lock my ass up. Mean group of people. Stan Parks was a master at that game. Him and Hoyt Allison. I had never told this one from the podium, but I had a new stereo thing that wasn't working out good. My sponsor, Bill Sanders, was out of town. He said, call Hoyt when I'm away. I said, okay. Called Hoyt, and he says, meet me downstairs at Nava. We'll have breakfast. I said, okay. Biggest mistake I ever made. If you haven't, you never even meet Hoyt. Hoyt was about this big, carried around an oxygen tank, real, real fragile. Now, we're downstairs, and I'm talking about this theater, this thing that's not hooking up, and he said, and I'm whining and pissing and moaning, and he goes, hold on, Larry, hold on. He goes, just got me a good one. He says, what were you talking about? I got a stereo that won't work, and he can't breathe. Doesn't take too many of them to make you go, damn, I'm a whiner. Anyway, I got up one Saturday morning, and y'all had told me I needed to pray on my knees, and Baptists don't pray on their knees because that's the way I was reared. But I was doing it anyway because I was scared not to. Got on my knees, and I said, God, I need your help, blah, 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 thank you this, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, I realized that there was nothing coming from my heart. It was all coming from my lips. It was a canned, prepared speech. And I felt guilty. I'd given birth to this little conscience. So I started calling all these people, couldn't get anybody, starting out with that old mean sponsor of mine. Ended up finally getting this one-armed lady named Jean Gray. Jean had about 50 years at that time, and she had an arm cut off at the shoulder, came from old Atlanta money, and she was very old Southern. Come to meetings all dressed in slinky silks and satins and dangly jewelry, that white hair up in a bun, and everybody was dolling. And I got Jean on the phone. She says, hello. I said, hi, Jean. It's Larry Scott. She says, hey, baby. How you doing, darling? I said, well, Jean, I got this problem. I got up this morning and I prayed and all my prayers are coming from my lips. Nothing's coming from my heart and it doesn't feel very good. There's this long pause. She says, well, darling, pray about it. We rock along. I got 5 years now. 5 years dry. I don't know anything about this. Got it. Don't know anything about it. I'm on the porch smoking cigarettes, fellowshipping, just not drinking and going to meetings. If you'd have lit a cigarette near me, I'd have probably gone up in flames. I was so dry. There was a period, 1992, I'm being sponsored by the biggest damn fool you've ever met in your life, and we were making horrible decisions together. And this guy's name is Larry Scott. Biggest fool you ever met in your life. Well, I wandered into a speaker meeting one night, and Bill Sanders was spinning his yarn, a little place out in Norcross called Log Cabin. And you told me that I would meet this guy on my path that would be that guy, that I could hook up with that would be my guide. And within 5 minutes of his talk, he was my guy. And Bill became my sponsor for 17 years. And what this man did is he put my hand into the sober men of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm no longer chasing the skirts. These men in turn taught me how to be a gentle man. I love the men of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I absolutely cherish the relationships that I have with the women in Alcoholics Anonymous because they have long since become a human being instead of an object for Larry Scott. Bill taught me to go to men's gatherings. We did the Atlanta Men's Workshop. We've done the Back to Basics in California, the Central Florida, all over the country. Men's gatherings. Did not sound real appetizing. 400 guys in the woods at a 4-H camp for the weekend? Are you kidding me? But it was an incredible lesson that I had the opportunity to live. My sponsor now is a guy by the name of Bob Crawford. I've known Bob for 20-some-odd years, and our relationship is built in spiritual principle and exchanging various prayers and things over the years. And for the last 6 years, Bob has been my sponsor. And he fits the description. There's a pamphlet over here. It's a green pamphlet. It's called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what that is, it's a summation of a talk given by a guy named Alan McGinnis back in the day. Great pamphlet, about 25 pages. Grab it, read it. It's incredible. But somewhere around page 10 or 11, depending on the printing, what Alan said, he says, I am convinced, he says, I am personally convinced that the basic search of every human being from the cradle to the grave is to find at least one other human being before whom he can stand completely naked, stripped of all pretense or defense, and trust that other person not to hurt him. Because you see, this other person has stripped himself naked too. This basic search can begin to end with your very first AA encounter. This is my experience. My guy knows it all. I have no secrets. I did some stupid stuff Saturday. Really stupid stuff. Stand here with 23 and a half years. Did some stupid stuff. Told my sponsor today, I said, I need to come see you because he lives in Gainesville. I'm going to have to wear some asbestos underwear because I got it coming. I mean, he's going to burn my blood up. But you know, my guy knows it all. And what I invite you to do is look at your own life. And if you've got something that you're harboring that your person, your guy, or your gal doesn't know, please don't sit on that. That's spiritual pain in the making. That's a bomb, man. It'll kill you better than fried chicken. Just my experience. Somewhere in the 90s, I ran into a couple of guys that I hadn't seen in some time. I went to a meeting strictly for fellowship to say, hey, what's up, guys? And what happened during, or as a byproduct of that, these guys were ingrained in the Joe and Charlie style book study, and they gave us 6 months of their life and took me and my sponsor family through the book. At the end of that six-month period, it was a Tuesday night, I said, guys, thank you so much for your sacrifice and your knowledge and blah, blah, blah. And they said, Bubba, that ain't the way this ends. I thought they were kidding. Really? And I said, what do you mean? Well, you've got to carry this yet to others. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'll get around to that. I mean, I'm busy. I got a busy life. Motorcycles, blah, 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 blah. I'm an important guy. Well, Thursday night. Tuesday night is when this conversation took place. Thursday night, the phone rings, and it's my buddy Rob. He says, Larry, I've been carrying this message down at the Triangle Room for blah, blah, blah. I can't be there tonight. You need to go do it. And I said, yeah, but. And he went, and I showed up at Triangle. I'd never conducted a book study, never facilitated one. And it's not a discussion meeting. Joe and Charlie, if you haven't had the pleasure to listen to their CDs, please do. They're teachers. And I had the information. I made the marks and the underlines and the highlights and all this stuff in my books. I had the information. And I showed up and there were probably 50 more people than there are here tonight. And it went well. Nobody died. There was no blood drawn. And from that night to this, 17 years maybe, there's not been 1 week. This is God's deal, not Larry's. Not 1 week passed that I haven't done at least one book study somewhere. For the last 5-6 years, we've been over at We Are Not a Glum Lot every Thursday night. But we have the honor and the privilege to carry this all over the globe and meet people. And what we're discovering, there are these pockets of enthusiasm of people that are starved to death for this information, the solution, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a really cool deal when you walk in. We were in Nova Scotia last September. And the majority of the room were like in their 20s, early 30s, and they were absolutely, it was like walking into a herd of zebras, if you're a zebra. I mean, I went, I'm home. And we got a standing re-invite up there, but you run into these people. I hammer this book because here's the deal. This book, I mean, I was invited to lead a meeting at Triangle, and they said, well, you can come down, but they voted the book out of the meeting. I said, you're kidding me. Nope, can't come out of the book. Well, you know how that went over. But anyway, there are people in this room tonight, and there are people that are walking through that door and doors of Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world for their first time. Everybody in this room walked through the door of AA for the first time. You didn't fall out of your mama's womb in an AA meeting. If you did, God, I'd love to meet you, but that's probably not the same situation. We wander in here because we're dying of a disease that's killing us. We have something that is killing us just exactly like cancer is killing cancer patients or AIDS is killing AIDS patients. There's no difference. It's a fatal disease. And what they're doing is they're coming in, they're poking around, they've got prejudice, they've got contempt, they've got fear out in the parking lot, and they're going, what are these people going to look like? What are they going to say? What are they going to expect of me? Am I going to handle snakes? Are they going to make me do this? Or what's the deal? We didn't know. We walk in here, and we're dying of alcoholism, and somebody says, oh, it's okay, bud. Just don't drink and go to meetings. Just don't drink no matter what. What does that mean? It's a beautiful summer night. I got a couple of bikes in my garage. Call Tim. Hey, buddy, I'm sorry. It's too pretty. I can't make it. I'm just going to not drink tonight. I'm going to go for a motorcycle ride. Get Tim to stand at the podium. When these people come in here, they're desperate. They have the desperation of burning people. And it's our job, it's our call, it's our charge to tell these people that we are people with a real solution to alcoholism. I was in a meeting in a small town, Florida, not long ago. Discussion meeting. This woman said, my name is Inez and I'm an alcoholic. She died at Applebee's yesterday. I got a salad. You wouldn't believe how many cucumbers on that salad. I said, really? Really? We're going to talk about cucumbers? There's some guy over here vibrating because he's just coming out of delirium tremens. Cucumbers on the salad? Really? How about, you know, I was out trimming my garden this morning, my weed whacker broke down. Really? Come out of Walmart, went down to get some Tide detergent, and somebody's run a shopping cart in the car door. Really? Yep, them kids are making horrible grades. I don't know what I'm going to do with them. Really? Guys, what are we talking about here? If you're armed with the information about yourself and about the solution, please, 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 take care of our young. They're coming in the door. They're the future for tomorrow. And I'm sorry if I come off as a preacher. I'm not. I'm watching people die because we're not telling them the truth about alcoholism and the solution. Kind of like telling a homeless guy, say, homeless person, go get a house. Bill W. wrote an article. I've got it. I'm going to pull it out on you. He wrote this article back in the day. He says, though a member sometimes may be helped in such matters by his friends in AA, and the primary responsibility for the solution of all the problems of living, growing rests squarely upon the individual himself. Should an AA group attempt this sort of help, its effectiveness and energies will be hopelessly dissipated. Here it is, right here. This is why sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of AA's 12 steps, is the sole purpose of the group. I didn't hear anything about cucumbers. It says, if we don't stick to this cardinal principle, we shall almost certainly collapse. And if we collapse, we can't help anyone. What he said is, if AA ever collapses, it'll be at the hands of the fellowship because the program is perfect. Make sense? There's two kinds of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's the cats like Tim and these guys that come in here and they turn on the lights, they make the coffee, they put out the literature, they get the speakers, they give rides, they sponsor people. And then you got those are the players. And then we got the fans that show up. Fans come in and sit in the chairs that have been set up. They drink the coffee that's been made, they take the pamphlets that have been put out, they take the rides to the meetings. Rarely do they put a dollar in a basket. And it was posed to me back during a conference some years ago, what are you going to be, Larry? Are you going to be a player or a fan? Being a member, an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous is not convenient. It's just not convenient. But you know what? Neither was drinking. All that planning and scheming and all the things that I had to do in order to stay loaded the way I like to stay loaded. The fellowship has been with Larry Scott through death, divorce, bankruptcy, you name it. The fellowship of AA is a lot of fun. We just got back from Akron a week ago. We were up at Founders Day and having a ball. If you haven't been to Founders Day, please go. It's like going to Mecca, and I could give you an hour talk on that. We do sober cruises. We do all kinds of sober stuff together. It's quite the deal if you get in the middle of it and not stay around the periphery. In 2001, actually, I got a phone call from my brother's partner, my brother's life partner. He'd been with him 37 years. Don called and said, "You need to come now." He lived in Carrollton. I lived in Suwanee. The same cat that gave me this book, the same cat that put my hand in your hand. He says, your brother's had a stroke and you need to come now. So I showed up at Tanner Medical Center. And when I got there, guess what I saw? I saw you. You were there. Walked in and I saw my brother, and he couldn't talk. He had a ventilator and all kind of heart monitors and everything else on him. This is the man that gave me a second chance at life through introduction to you. You were there. That's the decision, the most difficult decision of my life was made to unplug the machine and let it slip away. You were there. You held me. You held my family, and you prayed with us. And the day that we took that final ride to the graveside, I looked over my shoulder and you were there. You had me flanked. Not only did you have me, you had my family. And in my 23 plus years, you've always been there if I would allow you to be there. 2006, I went into Piedmont Hospital for a routine heart catheter because that crap runs rampant in my family. They got me jacked up on that stuff. They jack you up on pretty good stuff they got down there. And I lay there and freezing my butt off. And the doctor says, "You see that spot up on the TV screen?" I said, "Yep." He said, "You know what that is?" I said, "Nope." He said, "That's a block." I said, "Really? I'm pretty loaded." He said, "What do you think we ought to do?" I said, "Hell, you're the doctor. What do you think?" He said, "Well, I think we ought to do a bypass." And I'm thinking, you know, they're going to run something up my leg into my heart and blah, blah, blah. Well, little did I know that jacked up decision that I made where they were going to split my chest open and play with my heart. Didn't know that was going to happen. I wasn't in for that. But in the days preparing for that surgery, I looked over my shoulder and you were there. You were there the whole time. You never left me alone. You would show up in my room with books and you'd show up in my room with prayer groups. You'd show up in my room and hold my family and give them the assurance of a family that knows me better than my own blood. I died on the table. I hemorrhaged. Don't know any of this, but they came and got me out of intensive care and took me back and busted my chest open again, and you were there. On the road to recovery, you were there. You picked me up and I had to ride in the back seat of your car to stay away from the airbags. You carried me to meetings and you stayed with my family during those crucial days. On my walk, I've become an 11-step seeker. There were a couple of gals that used to frequent this room, and back in the day, I walked up to them and said, "You guys always look so damn happy. What's the deal?" They said, "Well, we've been prayer partners for 15 years, and they taught me and another guy who I still sponsor to this day this prayer thing. I don't know what to call it. And for the last 18 years, I've had a prayer partner, and I pray routinely every Thursday night at 7:30 with a group of men. It's not a Christian prayer. It's a prayer of seeking. And here's what I get when I pray. I get four answers, one of four. The first one is yes. I love that answer. I love yes. Second answer is no. I'm not crazy about that one. Third answer I get is not right now. I don't like that one at all because I don't like to wait. I want what I want and I want it right now. And the fourth answer I get is I can't believe you prayed that shit. And I'm guilty. We were in Iceland last March a year ago. I was over with a couple of guy out of Texas and a gal from California. And on Saturday, I was had the opportunity to present a 11-step workshop. And people in Iceland speak English, but they don't speak great English. Their language is Icelandic. It's indigenous to that country. And after I got done, this big cat comes up. I mean, this guy had to be 6'6". His name was Jan. Big guy. He was from north of Reykjavik in a little town called Akureyri. He says, "May I come to your room?" He was in the same hotel. "May I come to your room and pray with you in the morning?" What am I going to say? No. I said, "You bet." So at 8:30 the next morning, I open the door and there's Jan. He comes in and he speaks really broken English. So we sat down and I explained this prayer thing to him. And we held hands and I started praying. And when I got done, I squeezed his hands to signal it was his turn. Well, he started praying in English, really bad English. About 10 seconds into it, he's got hold of my hands and he starts doing this and jerking me all over the place. I said, "What?" He says, "I must meet God in my tongue." I said, "Go with it." He starts praying to a God that I don't understand in a language that I have no idea of what he's talking about. And all of a sudden, the realization came that I'm hanging on to a guy, and I know about his life. I've seen his wife. I know about his life back in Akureyri. And I could feel the moisture dripping off my chin as he met his God in his tongue. And I have the opportunity to do that with men all over the place. There's a guy that prays with us on Thursday night that prays Native American tongue. And that's some cool stuff. It's really been cool to be here with you guys. The energy in this room for you new kids that are here. This is a sacred place. I heard an old timer one time call this the granddaddy of clubhouses. I heard that in California. They'd heard about Napa. You don't see many clubhouses that have got a restaurant downstairs. I mean, really. It's been really cool to spend this hour with you, and I thank you for spending an hour of your life with me. In closing, the final word is namaste. The God in me recognizes the God in you. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry, for sharing the solution. That's fantastic. Tinsley's going to hand out chips.
Tim's technically an alcoholic. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Would anybody like to pick up a white chip? After 30 days, we offer a silver chip. Anybody got 30 days? Anybody got 3 months? Red chip. Anybody got 6 months? All right. Green chip for 9 months. Anybody got 9 months? How about a year or multiples? My birthday?
I'm Ken. I'm an alcoholic. And this is 4 years. It's only by God's grace that I stand here, and I love what this gentleman, what Larry shared, because for me, it does require work, and it does require willingness. Having a conference sponsor with the knowledge of the 12 and 12, being willing to take the suggestions, working with others, practicing these principles in all my affairs, one day at a time, and I stand before you, so thank you.
Any other birthdays? Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Big hand for the chips you hold.
Thank you, Kinsley. We have a moment for AA announcements. Any AA announcements? Tim, you got some?
Yeah, Tim, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. Larry, it's a great night. And good things. We get a couple of people that have cleaned up the back, and we're straightening up a little bit. We appreciate it. Also, check NowClub.org in a couple of days. This talk will be on there along with about 100 others.
With Larry's permission. Yes, Frank.
I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Frank.
And membership to NAVA is available. There are a few spots open, so if you'd like to become a member of NAVA, see me after the meeting. And myself up here have a piece of literature cabinet and the literature behind the back is for sale. The one by studying those pamphlets are for the day.
Okay, and next week, TJC, that's a lot of initials, TJC, is going to tell his story. He is giving up his Monday night home group at Biscayne. He's a 12-step titan. And he also comes here on Thursday night for the men's group meeting at 8 o'clock. And then the week after that, Donna P. Tells her story. She is way over 30 years now, looks like a teenager, does all of our, keeps up with our website, NAVAClub.org, so please support Donna as well. And I'd like to remind you, if there's nothing else, that anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Ever remind us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you.